In Iran, people who speak out against the government can be arrested and then sent to a mental health facility.
The aim is really to say that what these people are calling for is just the hallucinations of an unwell person.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. How Iran's government uses the accusation of mental illness to crush dissent. Also, the U.S. will now provide Ukraine with landmines that are banned in much of the world. The bans exist for a reason.
The devastating impacts continue for a long, long time after the guns fall silent.
And why Greeks are staging a nationwide strike, a brief history of sonic weaponry, and the man who helped Americans learn to travel.
Plus, decommissioned trains from the U.S. are being put to good use in Latin America.
It's not every day you ship a whole rail fleet to Peru.
All today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. Iranian authorities say that a young woman who was detained early this month at a university in Tehran has been released and returned to her family. The scene leading up to her detention grabbed attention globally when it circulated on social media.
The video shows the young woman pacing on the campus grounds wearing just her underwear. According to news reports, she stripped off most of her clothes after an altercation with security forces. Women in Iran are legally required to cover their bodies and their hair in public. If they don't, they can end up in prison. Iranian news reports said this particular woman was taken to a psychiatric hospital. As The World's Shirin Jafari reports, Iran has a history of accusing dissenters of being mentally unstable.
It was a cold February morning in 2018, and Azam Jangravi was walking along one of the busiest streets in Tehran. She planned a protest, but she wasn't sure if she wanted to carry it out. But she said she remembered everything she had gone through to get a divorce from her husband and to get custody of her only daughter. All the ways in which women in Iran face injustices, she says. Our generation has suffered a lot, she tells me, tears rolling down her face. I didn't want my daughter to grow up in the same environment. But she also knew what she was about to do was going to cost her. She was shaking, she says, as she stepped on top of a utility box and removed her hijab. She pulled out a white headscarf from her bag and began to wave it in the air in silence. This video was taken by one of the bystanders and posted online. A large crowd gathered. 45 minutes later, security forces shoved Jangravi into a car and took her away. Jangravi became part of a movement in Iran called the Girls of Revolution Street. It began in 2017 and it involved young women climbing up on utility boxes, uncovering their heads and waving white headscarves in the air. Many got arrested and jailed. I wasn't only protesting against the mandatory hijab, Jangravi says. I was defying a society that doesn't support survivors of rape. I was asking to be given the right to choose what I want to wear. Jangravi spent the next 10 days in jail until one day one of her relatives showed up. He said the authorities had pressured her family to declare her mentally ill. She would be admitted to a psychiatric hospital. I told him not to do it, she says. I cried and begged him not to lie. Her family accepted her pleas, and she was sentenced to 3 years in prison. As she waited for her appeal, Jangravi and her daughter fled to Turkey and then to Canada. Jangravi works three jobs now, and she says if she was as mentally ill as the Iranian authorities claimed, she wouldn't be able to do that. Gisunia, a human rights lawyer, says this is a well-known tactic by the Iranian authorities. It has grown since the start of the Women Life Freedom Movement, she says.
It's been targeted against artists, activists, journalists, lawyers. The aim is really to say that what these people are calling for is just the hallucinations of an unwell person.
Nia adds that the lesson here is for the rest of the public to not dare get out of line. She has interviewed former prisoners who have told her they were injected with substances that were supposed to calm them down.
Sometimes there is involuntary psychiatric hospitalization that is used, which is very extreme.
It's often women protesters who face being labeled as mentally ill, she says. Last year, a famous actress, Afsana Bayagan, was sentenced to weekly therapy sessions. But it's not limited to women. Rapper Salman Yasin, who had joined the protests in 2022, was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Yasin is from the northwestern Kurdish region of Iran. He was admitted to a psychiatric center, according to reports. He was released on bail 3 weeks ago. Nia, the lawyer, says other authoritarian governments like Russia and China use this tactic, especially against women.
This is something that is that you see throughout history, where women who didn't conform to societal norms were labeled as deviant, mentally unwell, and in need of psychiatric treatment.
More recently, psychologists and psychiatrists in Iran have spoken out against this type of punishment. Nia says it would help if global bodies like the World Health Organization issue guidelines stating that mental illness should not be weaponized. Last week, the Iranian government announced a new plan to open treatment clinics for women who defy the mandatory hijab. Rokhsare Mohammadkhani, who was involved in the protests in Iran, says the message the government is trying to send is clear.
These people are mad, and we need some clinic if they dare to defy social expectations.
Mohammadkhani moved to the UK in 2019 and works as a data scientist. She says she was disturbed when she saw the reactions to the recent video of the young woman in Tehran who had stripped down to her underwear.
I mean, when someone is under immense social and governmental pressure to assert control over their body, so they may resort to extreme acts to communicate their autonomy.
Mohammadkhani recreated that scene in London. She wore a bikini and walked around in Trafalgar Square holding up a placard that read, "Standing up for rights is not madness, it's courage." She says it might seem like the government has been successful at silencing the protests in Iran, but that doesn't mean they have ended.
I think we are in a journey. The cultural change that we are witnessing is kind of necessary steps that we need to go through before we will get to the point.
Much has changed since the early days of the movement, she says, and the government knows that. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafori.
Greece basically ground to a halt today after workers across the country walked off the job. Thousands marched in Athens to protest the rising cost of living and stagnant wages. Greece is still recovering from a nearly 10-year debt crisis that nearly pushed it out of the eurozone. Since 2018, the Greek economy has been on the upswing, but many workers are not seeing the benefits in their own lives. Daphne Tolis is a reporter based in Athens.
It was quite big. Approximately 12,000 protesters gathered in Athens, which is the capital of Greece, and an additional 5,000 people participated in Thessaloniki, Greece's second largest city, during this 24-hour general strike that was organized by labor unions. It was quite vibrant, as expected. Of course, the weather was good. It was sunny. So many also students participated, and public and private sector workers, including medical staff at state-run hospitals, teachers, and of course the public transport, which only the metro was running from 9 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, evening, which facilitated, you know, people's participation to the strike in Athens. Other than that, most public transport was ground to a halt, and the ferries as well were grounded, the ferries connecting the islands to the mainland, participating as well in this strike.
So labor unions, as you said, called this 24-hour strike. Do they have specific demands? I mean, this is about cost of living.
Yes, they demand the wage increases, basically to combat the rising costs of living and the inflation, as well as better working conditions across the industries and some collective bargaining, as they say. They emphasize the need for more substantial investments in healthcare, education, and other public services. Some groups also advocated for a reallocation of the priorities of this government, including reducing the military expenditures to focus on more social welfare programs. So Basically, the demand is mainly this, that the incomes must increase to cope with inflation and the rising living costs, as well as the housing. We're also facing problem with, you know, people in big cities trying to find affordable housing that can match the salaries. You have slow increases to the salaries since 2019, which is when this current government came into power. And over the last decade, since the financial crisis in Greece in 2010, the salaries and the pensions have faced significant fluctuations, cuts because of the financial and economic crisis. There's been a recovery ever since, but not to the extent that it can actually stand up to these rising costs.
So will the hangover from the 2019 debt crisis continue to prevent wages in Greece meeting what the people on strike today are hoping for?
I think there is a significant pressure on the government because they see they try to make some adjustments, some measures, including regulating some prices in the supermarkets, but it doesn't reflect the general feeling of people and how they make ends meet. Of course, we have tourism, which this year is expected to be a landmark year with 35 million tourists and 22 billion, I think, in revenue. And that reflects, again, a rise from previous years. But still, although Greece has achieved economic growth and regained some investment grade status, we still have the highest debt to GDP ratio. And doesn't seem that people and the workers are satisfied or can make ends meet if there is no more significant wage improvements and maybe tackling the cost of living, including housing.
So all of Greece has been on strike today, Daphne. What will happen when people wake up tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow, everyone will be going to their work. All public transport will be reinstated. Medical workers will go back to the hospital. Teachers will go back to teach at school. Life will continue. Tomorrow is going to be a busy and vibrant day again.
Yeah, so what then would be the impact of going on strike?
The impact is that it's a strong signal of a large part of the population to the government saying that we are dissatisfied. We are struggling. We see that the country is doing well in other terms, in tourism, but we are struggling with our current wages, with our current spending power, with our current incomes. You know, you have to do something differently. You have to increase the salaries. You have to lower the taxes for the freelancers, for example. There's many self-employed people that pay very high taxes. So something has to be done, and some measures to protect the cost of rents that have been going up. Many people will rent their apartments and will put them up on Airbnbs, but that leaves less apartments for people to actually be able to rent. So these concerns will not go away. We see if there's any response to these demands made today. Otherwise, I think people will again take to the streets.
Daphne Tolis, a reporter based in Athens, was telling us there about the 24-hour nationwide strike today in Greece. Far from striking, they are celebrating in San Marino. The tiny landlocked nation-state inside Italy has lived with the worst ranking of any national team in men's soccer, 210 out of 210. Things are different, though, right now. San Marino this week beat tiny Liechtenstein the second time since September.
It is the stuff of football fantasy. An ambition fulfilled that seems so remarkable.
Now San Marino has earned a promotion in the Nations League.
2 months ago, you would have been crazy to even have foreseen that this was possible. But San Marino, thanks to goals from Lazzari, Captain Nicola Nalli, and Alessandro Garnucci, have come from behind to win in Liechtenstein by 3-1.
The win puts San Marino at the top of its group and opens a tiny window for the qualifiers for the 2026 World Cup. It is a long shot, but still closer than ever for the country of 35,000 people.
You are listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Shirin Jafari, a reporter for The World, where I cover the Middle East. As you know, we've been following the Israel-Hamas war closely, even as it was just beginning to develop. In March, I traveled on board a Jordanian aid plane to understand the challenges in delivering essential supplies to Gaza. I wanted to give our listeners an inside look at the risks and dedication involved in getting even small amounts of aid to the people of Gaza. More recently, I shared the powerful story of photographer Rania Matar. Matar's iconic photo, Barbie Girl, captured destruction and rebirth in Beirut following the 2006 Israeli invasion. This October, as Lebanon braced for another invasion from Israel, Matar connected with her photo's subject, now 19-year-old Lynn Abbas. their reunion brought a glimmer of hope amidst the violence, a reminder that Beirut might rebuild again, despite uncertainty. Stories like these may only last minutes on air, but the work behind them takes months, even years, of building relationships and establishing sources. Reporting on these events is essential, and it requires your support. The World is an independent, non-profit newsroom. We're not funded by billionaires. Instead, we rely on listeners like you. As we approach the end of year, we're aiming to raise $67,000, and we're counting on your help. A generous donor has pledged to match every gift dollar for dollar. So if you give $25, it turns into $50 for the newsroom. If you give $250, that becomes $500. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. I really can't emphasize how much your support means to our newsroom. Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. With only 2 months before President Biden leaves office, his administration is pushing through a flurry of measures designed to help Ukraine hold the line against invading Russian troops. Earlier this week, Washington approved the use of U.S.-made long-range missiles to strike deep inside Russian territory. Now, in another policy shift, the White House has announced it will provide Ukraine with anti-personnel landmines. Biden's Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said the mines would be used to slow down the Russian advance and replace the inferior ones that the Ukrainians are deploying now.
They're fabricating their own anti-personnel landmines right now. The landmines that we would look to provide them would be landmines that that are not persistent. You know, we can control when they would self-activate, self-detonate, and that makes it far more safer eventually than the things that they are creating on their own.
To learn more about this, we called Patrick Thompson. He's a Ukraine researcher with Amnesty International. I asked him how the Ukrainians would deploy these new landmines.
It's been reported that Ukrainians have committed to not using these landmines in densely populated areas. But beyond that, it's not really clear. Certainly, I don't think the sort of operational decisions would be made widely public anyway.
The U.S. has already provided anti-tank mines to Ukraine and remote-controlled anti-personnel mines as well. How are these mines, which are being called non-persistent, different?
Non-persistent generally would mean a landmine that was powered by a battery. So eventually, batteries may run out of charge, and these particular devices may have a self-destruct capacity that would enable them to self-destruct after a set amount of time. But those sort of safety measures don't change the fact that these weapons are still inherently indiscriminate, and they're still not able to distinguish between civilians and military. And whether these mines are self-activating or not, they will still require complex mine clearance, which is a very sort of costly, time-intensive effort. And the self-destruct mechanisms and the deactivation is not always fail-safe. Sometimes there can still be a little bit of juice left in a battery after a long time, as I'm sure your listeners are aware. So the idea that this is 100% fail-safe is simply not the case.
The anti-tank mines that the U.S. previously sent, were those non-persistent as well?
There are certain types of anti-tank mine which also have self-destruct mechanisms. However, from a legal point of view, it's less important, as the same sort of international legal frameworks don't apply to anti-vehicle mines. And it's a much stricter obligation on the prohibition of anti-personnel mines.
What was the hesitation from the U.S. to send these non-persistent mines until now, if they do expire after a certain period?
The fact that they do reportedly expire after a certain period doesn't change the fact that they are inherently indiscriminate weapons that are illegal under international law. And the United States has not signed the Ottawa Convention or the Anti-Personnel Landmine Ban Convention, but in some ways it has been a sort of global leader in not only funding mine clearance efforts around the world, but under this policy introduced, I believe, by President Obama, the U.S. committed to not exporting or using anti-personnel mines outside the Korean Peninsula. And this policy was then rescinded under President Trump, brought in again by President Biden, but this decision today effectively amounts to a sort of U-turn on that, which may undermine undermine U.S. leadership on this issue and undermine the global effort to eradicate the use of anti-personnel mines in armed conflict around the world.
Patrick, I know that you have experience clearing landmines in Ukraine, and you were just there last month. What has that work taught you about the longer-term impact of these sorts of weapons for ordinary civilians?
The long-term effects of landmines are devastating. Almost half of recorded landmine casualties since 1999 are children. They continue to kill and injure long after the conflicts are over. They render otherwise productive agricultural lands unsafe to use. The devastating impacts continue for a long, long time after the guns fall silent.
What has your on-the-ground work in Ukraine shown you about how this impacts people that are living there? What have you seen?
Earlier this year, I traveled to areas of Ukraine that were previously occupied by the Russian armed forces. What we found there was evidence that the Russian armed forces had used anti-personnel mines in residential areas. And there was evidence that these anti-personnel mines had been used in a way that was meant to deliberately target the civilian population. And if that were to be the case, then that would amount to a war crime. And I met people who've lost limbs, people whose relatives have been killed. There are a number of people who have been forced to use their agricultural land despite knowing that it was contaminated with landmines. They were forced to take, you know, incredible risks through either sort of doing bespoke amateur demining themselves of their fields or just cultivating those fields despite knowing that there were potentially landmines in the soil. So those were the kind of decisions faced by people every day in Ukraine.
Patrick Thompson is a researcher with Amnesty International. He spoke with us about the U.S. decision to provide landmines to Ukraine.
In the past year, people from the U.S. made close to 100 million trips abroad. These days, Americans leave the country a lot and typically plan their own trips.
That wasn't always the case, though. One of the reasons Americans got more comfortable globetrotting was Arthur Frommer, who died this week at age 95.
To fully appreciate how much travel evolved in Frommer's lifetime, check out the scene from the 1969 movie, If This Is Tuesday, It Must Be Belgium, a comedy about Americans touring Europe on a budget, where a tour company made all the decisions for travelers.
I have relatives in Italy. Now, if I eat all my meals with them while we're there, can I apply for a refund?
It's the same for everybody. 9 countries, 18 days, $448.50. No refund.
Arthur Frommer wanted to help ordinary Americans see the world on a shoestring budget. He told the Associated Press several years ago that that dream took hold when he was a young man serving in U.S. Army intelligence in Berlin in 1955.
While in the Army overseas, I was always struck by the fact that my fellow GIs did not travel. They were scared to travel. They were worried about how you would pay for various items. What currency would you use? Where would you live at night? And I decided to do a guidebook.
He wrote a manual called The GI's Guide to Traveling in Europe, which he later expanded into his first guidebook for general readership, Europe on $5 a Day. It came out in 1957 and was an immediate bestseller.
The Europe on $5 a Day was the first of our books. I followed that up working with other journalists. We brought out a book called Mexico on $5 a Day. And then we did New York on $5 a Day. And then we did the Caribbean on $10 a Day.
At the time, that emphasis on budget was no accident. Americans didn't just need information to start planning their own trips. They needed to be convinced that they could afford it in the first place.
Frommer's early guides provided simple rules for first-time travelers abroad. Take a cheaper room without a bath. Eat in restaurants frequented by locals. Engage them in conversation. Take public transport and never travel first class.
Even after he'd built a whole travel guide empire, Frommer kept updating his first book until the final edition in 2007. By then, though, inflation had forced a branding change. Europe on $5 a Day had become Europe from $95 a Day.
You're listening to The World. After the Soviet Union collapsed, people there started joining faith groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses.
There was a spiritual hunger in Russia at that time to have a relationship with God, to be religious.
But Jehovah's Witnesses have since been labeled an extremist group by Russian authorities, and they're facing a crackdown. That's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. About a year ago, Italy signed a controversial agreement with Albania on migration. Here's how it's supposed to work. When foreign men, and this only applies to men from certain countries, they're picked up at sea by Italian authorities, they are then sent to a detention facility built for this purpose in Albania. The migrants are to remain there while their applications for asylum are processed. European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said this arrangement could serve as a model for other EU governments, but things are not going according to plan, as the world's Orla Barry reports from northern Albania.
The remote village of Jadr is just a couple of minutes' drive from Albania's new multi-million dollar migrant detention facility. Alexander Preka, the village leader as he's known locally, seems to run half the businesses here.
Come buy, come supermarketing, come the autobus.
I own the bar, the supermarket and six buses, he says. Only around 700 people live in the small village. Most of the young people have emigrated, Preka says, to find work elsewhere. When locals first heard about plans to open a huge detention facility nearby, they were very upset, he says. They worried about an increase in crime, he says. But Preka, who once lived abroad himself, saw an opportunity. He told his neighbours that having new people from different backgrounds moving to the town would be good for the community and would bring in some badly needed business. When workers arrived to start construction, they stayed in the village. We were happy, Preka says. But then they discovered that the detention facility, which was built to house 3,000 people a month, was going to be closed off from the village. The asylum seekers wouldn't be allowed to leave. We found that really depressing, he says. It made us think how other countries might be treating our people when we emigrate, he says. I go to the detention facility nearby. A 6-metre-high steel fence runs along the outside of the building. It looks like a prison. As I approach the gates, a security guard appears, speaking in Italian. He tells me I've no right to walk around the grounds without accreditation from the Italian government. The centre operates under Italian jurisdiction. I've been asking the Foreign Ministry for permission to access the centre for weeks, but to date haven't received a response. Human rights groups say holding asylum seekers in a facility like this breaks international law. Albanian lawmaker Tony Gogu says that's Italy's problem.
According to the agreement, it's the Italian authorities that are responsible for their treatment within the compound, in the port, and as they travel between the two.
Understood. But does it make you uncomfortable to know that NGO groups and human rights groups say it's illegal and inhumane to keep people detained? I mean, it's Italian jurisdiction, as you say, but it's in Albania.
As it is written in the agreements, it will make us uncomfortable as long as the Italian jurisdiction, Italian courts, will decide that this is not the way to treat them.
Albania doesn't profit from the migrant deal, the lawmaker says. We just want to return a favour to Italy.
We were the immigrants of the early 90s, and the Italians opened their houses for us.
Albanian Prime Minister Edi Rama is trying to help Italy and the EU solve its migration problem, he says. Edison Lika, a human rights activist in the capital Tirana, doesn't buy that.
In last 10 years, like 500,000 Albanians like just left the country. So if Rama really want to contribute to the crisis of migration, he just can make like better conditions in his country.
Lika says Albania may not benefit from the deal, but it may well secure Edi Rama brownie points with the EU. Albania is currently in talks to join the bloc, but the country's reputation for corruption is a serious obstacle. Senior members of Rama's own government have been accused and in some cases jailed for criminal behaviour in the last few years. Investigative journalist Besar Likmeta in Tirana says the deal is good for Rama, but not Albania.
Basically, he makes friends with other political leaders. Some political leaders in Europe turn a blind eye on his corruption. That's very simple.
Back in Jadr, the detention facility stands empty. The 24 or so asylum seekers who were brought here last month have been sent back to Italy because a court in Rome ruled that their detention in Albania contravened EU law. Still, shop owner Alexander Preca says he's happy his Prime Minister signed the deal. The village has been reinvigorated, he says. More people have jobs. I just hope that many more people will be brought here, he says, and that they'll be allowed to spend time with us here in the village. With that, Preca jumps into his bus and heads off to do his next job of the day. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in Jadar, Albania.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
The World Health Organization has authorized the first mpox vaccine for children. The single-dose vaccine could help control outbreaks of the disease in Congo, where children are disproportionately affected. The WHO had previously approved an mpox vaccine for people 18 and older.
The U.S. says Edmundo Gonzalez is the real president-elect of Venezuela. The country's presidential vote in July ended with President Nicolas Maduro claiming victory. The Biden administration had previously said that Gonzalez got the most votes in that election. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has now stated that it's Gonzalez who should have been the rightful winner.
A major storm passing through the South China Sea is now heading for southern China. The storm had been a typhoon when it passed over the Philippines earlier this week, leaving 7 people dead in a country that's been battered by back-to-back storms the past month. Climate experts are predicting a greater frequency of major storms, but better preparedness and early warning systems have helped prevent some of the worst possible consequences.
And that's a few things you might have missed. American trains recently taken out of service are getting a new life in Peru.
Trains connect people. They bring communities together.
That's Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking in Lima earlier this week, announcing that an entire fleet of decommissioned diesel engines and wagons from California is being sent there by cargo ship. The goal is to launch a new commuter rail line connecting Peru's capital city, Lima, to its eastern suburbs.
This rail line will expand access to reliable, affordable transportation for some 200,000 passengers every single day.
It's an unlikely second life for these American trains, as we hear from the world's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel.
There's no rule for what's supposed to happen to trains when they're taken off of the tracks, and that's become the source of intrigue for amateur investigators. In this YouTube video, a pair of self-proclaimed French explorers set out to find a graveyard of trains. What they found wasn't exactly out of the ordinary. French authorities were housing these high-speed trains on a big plot of land while they prepared for them to be scrapped, with parts recycled. Experts say that's what tends to happen to trains when they've reached the end of their life. What doesn't usually happen is an international expedition.
It's not every day you ship a whole rail fleet to Peru.
Dan Lieberman is with Caltrain, a commuter rail service in Northern California that's historically used diesel trains to serve riders around San Francisco and San Jose. Earlier this year, Caltrain went electric on their main line, leaving them with nearly 100 train cars they didn't need anymore. The transit agency's Sam Sargent was in charge of figuring out what to do with these extra trains. He decided to put them up online for sale.
We got, I'd say, hundreds of interested parties. They didn't specifically say what they wanted to do with them, but people of all ages and from around the United States and beyond were definitely interested in the equipment.
Sargent says they got some serious offers for a few cars here and there to preserve in museums or make artwork. Others wanted to open a diner inside of a train car. But the most intriguing pitch they got came from officials in Lima, who wanted every single one of the decommissioned trains.
What I think is so exciting about this transfer over to Lima, Peru, is that we're able to give this equipment a second life, actually moving human beings.
The fleet will be used for a new project spearheaded by the government of Lima with support from the U.S., aimed at connecting central Lima to suburban areas in the east. Lima's mayor, Rafael Lopez Aliaga, appeared alongside Secretary of State Antony Blinken to announce the deal.
Reemplaza a mucho bus costero, una cantidad enorme de tráfico.
He says the new commuter railway will help ease chaotic traffic in the region. Fabiola Alba Bibar was born and raised in Lima. She says, as a young student, it was nearly impossible to get from the outskirts of the city to the city center in that congestion.
I remember commuting like at least 1 hour or 1 hour and a half when I was like going to study, or like even up to 2 hours to get to the place where I used to work.
Alba Bibar is now an assistant professor of economics at Wake Forest, where she studies the effects of infrastructure projects in megacities like Lima, which has a population millions larger than New York City.
Lima, it's huge. The problem is, until very recently, there hasn't really been a systematic plan for like developing public transportation, like the way we will think about like the New York City subway.
Alba Bibar says over the past decade, the creation of new bus and metro lines has allowed for more people to get to jobs and school. And the new commuter rail, which aims to launch within a few years, could be transformative, especially for women in Lima, who face significant gender barriers and generally don't drive.
The fact that we might be able to get a better way of moving across a city that is slightly like friendlier toward women actually can boost labor market participation among women as well.
According to Alba Bibar, some Peruvians are frustrated that the city bought the old recycled trains from America rather than new ones, and they worry the equipment could be faulty. But Caltrain's Sam Sargent says these cars have a long life ahead of them. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
North Korea is turning up the volume across the border with South Korea. Instead of blasting propaganda over loudspeakers, the North Koreans are blaring really loud and unpleasant sounds toward the South. They range from gunshots to screams and other eerie sounds. According to South Koreans who live within earshot, this is excruciating. Toby Hayes is the author of Sound Pressure: How Speaker Systems Influence, Manipulate, and Torture. He's based in Manchester, England.
There are precedents to this type of sonic strategy. It's happened for decades and decades. A good example is the Croatian War of Independence during 1991 to 1995. Sound systems were used on the border to promote national identity. Changing tack to using noise, whether that's white noise or just random industrial noise, for example. Again, there's precedents for that. You know, if you look at Wandering Soul, The American military's strategy in Vietnam of using helicopter-mounted speakers to fly over the jungle canopy to keep people awake. It's difficult to function when you haven't slept the night before. If you haven't had a good night's sleep, obviously the next day if you're fighting, that's not great at all. And irrelevant of what you're doing, just going to work is difficult if you haven't had the correct rest.
Yeah, you're right. I think we can all identify with noises keeping you up being very annoying. What is the earliest instance you can think of where sound was used as a form of coercion or a weapon?
When people speak about this, it's usually the walls of Jericho that is referred to as the first instance of sound, the horns being blown, and them finding the resonant frequency of the walls and collapsing the walls. So that's the first kind of instance, in popular belief anyway, of sound being used in that manner.
Did sound and noise start as a form of communication by governments and the military, but then evolve into a weapon, or has it always had these two dual purposes?
I think speaker systems are probably the interesting thing to look at, especially the US military has got a very interesting history in this development, UK's military as well. If you look at the Second World War, you've got the Ghost Army, who was brought onto the front lines during the 1940s to fight the Nazis. They were using large speakers on trucks, and they would fill holes on the front line where there was no presence. And they would amplify and transmit sounds of tanks moving, of bridge building, of troops where there were none. It was used for deception. It was it was used to make the Nazis think that there was a huge presence of American or UK or military where there was none. So there's a really interesting, going back to the 40s, for example, really interesting use of sound. Field recordings that they did put onto record. The records were then played from these trucks. So those really were the first kind of battle DJs. I know battle DJs were obviously thought about as being hip hop, you know, kind of oriented, scratch oriented, but these were the real battle DJs. They were in battle and they were using music as a weapon.
When did sound and noise start being used as a form of torture?
I know in the 1970s, for example, the UK started using the kind of five techniques that later got used in Guantanamo Bay. A lot of the techniques from Guantanamo Bay, like short shackling, leaving inmates in darkness, playing sound for 24, 48, 72 hours repetitively. A lot of those techniques actually come from the UK's military playbook against IRA inmates or people from the IRA that had been captured, and they were basically tortured to try and gain information. I think it does go back before then. It's not super well documented, but in the 1970s, there is documentation and there's declassified documentation about the UK's use of noise in that way.
We've talked about a lack of sleep. What are the other health effects of using sound as a weapon?
Psychologically, there's a lot, and again, very well documented. If you look at Guantanamo Bay as a prime example of that, really interesting, well, interesting from a musicological kind of perspective. Lots of different types of music got used in Guantanamo Bay to torture inmates. In terms of what they're trying to achieve by playing music repetitively is mental breakdown, is the loss of cognitive action or cognitive thought, that weakening of a captive's resolve. It makes it easier to question them to derive the information that they're being asked for.
Is there any kind of international agreement on sonic weapons during war or interrogation?
One of the reasons why music is used is because, you know, it's not visual. So if you've got, you know, people who get released from Guantanamo Bay and they've got bruises all over them, cuts and broken arms and broken legs, etc., you cannot see they've been mistreated. If you use sound, you can't see that. It's not evident. It's not visible. So it's really easy to use it surreptitiously. I think it's also used because it's not taken seriously. We all listen to music, right? So it's like, how on earth can music be torture? But if you think of something being played repetitiously on the radio, hearing the same song two or three times in a couple of hours gets mildly annoying. Imagine hearing that over and over and over again for 2 or 3 days straight at deafening levels. So you've got the psychological and the physiological responses to that, which is why they use it. It's very effective.
Toby Hayes is a professor of digital arts at Manchester Metropolitan University in the UK.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Back in March, as you'll recall, the so-called Islamic State claimed responsibility for a deadly attack at a theater outside of Moscow. Since then, Russian security services have been cracking down on suspected extremists and occasionally putting out videos like this one. Here we see Russian police filming as officers barge into a man's apartment and arrest him. But this man was not part of ISIS. He was a Jehovah's Witness, the Christian denomination known for door-to-door proselytizing. The Russian government has designated Jehovah's Witnesses as extremists. In recent years, hundreds of members of the group have been arrested on charges that the European Court of Human Rights says are bogus. But as we hear from reporter Levi Bridges, the Russian approach is a central part of how the Kremlin deals with what it sees as dissent.
Nobody I talked to for the story could tell me why exactly Russia is jailing so many Jehovah's Witnesses. The group's adherents have lived in Russia for more than a century. In a video shot back in the 90s, a huge crowd of Jehovah's Witnesses packs into a Moscow stadium for a mass baptism. Dozens of adults in swimsuits jump into large swimming pools. They were making up for lost time. The Soviet Union had tried to create an atheist state. But after the USSR fell, Russians could practice religion more openly, and the number of Jehovah's Witnesses quickly grew.
There was a spiritual hunger in Russia at that time to have a relationship with God, to be religious.
Dennis Christensen is a Danish citizen who moved to Russia back then to help a congregation of Jehovah's Witnesses. But he says the spiritual environment changed as Russia grew more authoritarian and more orthodox under Putin. Then, around 2014, strange people started showing up at Christensen's church.
Like they were smoking cigarettes. And everybody knows that Jehovah's Witnesses are not smoking.
Even stranger, he says, they were pointing their cigarette packs at the congregation, like they were filming the services with hidden cameras. The surveillance eventually became more overt. But Christensen wasn't worried, because the Russian constitution guarantees freedom of religion.
We were sure of that we are not doing anything wrong.
But that sense of safety soon...
PRX.